Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the Mustard Seed of Central Florida, a furniture and clothing bank that helps rebuild the lives of people who have experienced homelessness, natural disaster, or personal tragedy. For over 35 years, the Mustard Seed has been helping those in need. More at mustardseedfla.org.
The wonders in the December night sky and China's race to the moon. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. For December, it's set to be a busy month for backyard stargazers. From meteor showers to the Gemini and Taurus constellations, space enthusiasts can see several astronomical events over the next few weeks. We'll speak with Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Terry Oswalt about what the December skies have in store for us and how we can check out the show. Then, it's once again a race to land humans on the moon, but this time, it's between China and the U.S. The Artemis program has been pushed back once again after recent technical issues with the Orion spacecraft. And Congress is sharing concerns to get the program back on track and beat China to the moon in the 21st century. We'll speak with Greg Autry, author of the book Red Moon Rising, How America Will Beat China on the Final Frontier, about China and America's race to the moon. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The weather's getting cooler, the skies are getting darker sooner, and it feels like winter. But technically, the season hasn't started yet. The winter solstice marks the start of the season on December 21st, but even though winter isn't in full swing until the end of the month, December is still full of cosmic phenomena. From a meteor shower to some of Earth's neighboring planets coming into full and bright view, December has a lot happening in the night sky. Here to talk about these notable events and some of his own images from other cosmic events this year is Terry Oswalt, an astronomer and the Associate Dean of Physical Sciences at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Always great to have you on to talk about the night sky, Terry. But let's talk a bit about the night temperature first. It's been bit chilly here where we are in Central Florida. I've been wearing layers that I'm not used to, but we're not really at winter yet. Winter truly starts with the winter solstice. When is it and what is the winter solstice?
The Earth goes around the sun in an orbit, as everybody knows, and the Earth's rotational axis is tilted by 23.5 degrees with respect to that orbit. And what that means is that during the time that we're on the side of our orbit, when the northern hemisphere is tilted towards the sun, we have summer in the north. But we're on the opposite side of our orbit right now, and so the Earth's northern pole is pointed away from the sun at the moment, and that means we get less sunlight, and what sunlight we get is less direct, and so the temperatures are lower. The converse of that is the reverse is happening in the southern hemisphere. They're getting towards summer down there. 4:17 a.m. if you want to go out and celebrate on December 21st is the first day of winter.
Well, I will say my favorite beer is named Winter Solstice from Anderson Valley, so I may wake up on December 21st and enjoy myself a winter solstice on the winter solstice at 4:17 a.m. That sounds like a plan.
Speaking of astronomy and beer, my favorite beer is a Japanese beer called Orion.
Can we see Orion this time of year, though?
Yes, you bet.
The new season also brings some showers, but not just any showers. We have a meteor shower coming up, right? The Geminid meteor shower?
Yeah, sort of a pre-Christmas present to us all is the king of all the showers called the Geminid meteor shower. And by shower, we don't mean the sky is completely covered with shooting stars, so to speak, something like 120 per hour, which is one or two every minute for an hour. That's a really good meteor shower. The best way to see a meteor shower is to go and put a blanket out on the ground and maybe cover yourself up a little bit, stay warm since it's cool, and just lay there with your eyes focused on the whole sky and probably see one or two every minute during the peak of the Geminid meteor shower on the night of the 13th and the 14th of December. There'll be a few before and after that. And roughly the week centered on that is when the Earth is passing through the debris from a former comet, call it a dead comet, actually now called an Apollo-type asteroid with the license plate number PHA-3200 and a proper name Phaeton. It was discovered by the IRAS infrared satellite about 30 years ago, 1983 to be exact. It is, of all the named asteroids, the one that comes closest to the sun. That's another clue that it's a dead comet, one that's passed so close to the sun many times it's lost all the gas and dust that normally makes a comet tail. And so this debris, the Earth passes through that orbit, and the orbit's full of the debris that's come off of that dead comet. It's like bugs hitting your windshield when you're driving down the street. And that's the reason why it's best to go out to see meteor showers after midnight and before dawn. The second half of the night is when we're on the front leading edge of the Earth as it's going around in its orbit. And so the bugs are hitting our windshield.
I like it. Orbital bugs hitting the windshield. Very cool. You know, one of the things that I love most about this time of year, Terry, is going outside. The air is crisp. The sky is usually quite clear. And I was just out recently and noticed quite a few planets up in the sky, these very, very bright objects. What planets are we able to see? I believe I was looking at Jupiter, but there are far more that are going to be out there, right?
Well, the two big bright objects that are visible in the evening right now are Venus out there in the west, southwest.
So that's what I saw then. I saw Venus then, yeah.
Yeah, that's the brightest object in the sky except for the sun and the moon. It'll actually throw a shadow if you're in a dark place. But anyway, if you've got binoculars and can hold them steady enough, like maybe propping your elbows up on a fence post or a windowsill, you can actually see that Venus has a little crescent shape. That's all you need. I mean, Galileo's original telescope was crappier than the cheapest binoculars you can buy at a discount store. So that's over there in the west after sunset. And Jupiter is almost as bright over in the east, rising at sunset. In fact, Jupiter is near opposition. Tomorrow night, it will be on the exact opposite side of the sun from us. And so it will rise at sunset, be up all night long, and set at sunrise, just like the full moon does. That also means it's closest to us. So in binoculars, you'll easily be able to see the four Galilean moons of Jupiter if you can hold your binoculars steady enough. This weekend, by the way, Jupiter will be slowly moving by the red giant star Aldebaran, which is the eyeball of Taurus the bull, that constellation, and also between the Pleiades, sometimes known as the Seven Sisters, and the Hyades, that V-shaped constellation that looks like the horns of Taurus the bull.
You mentioned binoculars as a way to see these planets. Terry, is that kind of the best entryway to getting into seeing the night sky with some tools by far?
Yes. I was probably 8 or 9 years old when my grandfather gave me his personal binoculars. I still have them today. They were one of the key things that got me interested in astronomy. And the reason they're so important to begin with is, A, they're not as expensive usually as a telescope. They can be, but it's easy to get a good pair of binoculars at a reasonable price. And more importantly, you can usually easily point binoculars towards something you can see with the naked eye and get a feel for the effects of magnification and how easy it is to point at things you don't see using the things around it that you do see. So binoculars makes that easy. Pointing a telescope takes some skill, and a lot of beginners get frustrated unless they start with the binoculars.
You alluded to this at the start of our conversation. I'm always thinking about beer. You mentioned your favorite beer was Orion. It's a constellation. What constellations can we see this winter?
Well, right now over in the east, the constellations of the Pleiades, which is technically an asterism, and Taurus the bull and Gemini are rising. Farther up in the sky is the constellation Andromeda and the square of Pegasus. Those two constellations are actually hooked together. If you can find the square of Pegasus nearly directly overhead as the sky gets dark after sunset, the northwest corner of that square of Pegasus is close to where the Andromeda galaxy is. And the Andromeda galaxy is a bigger galaxy than our own Milky Way, and it is one of the only objects outside our Milky Way that you can see with the naked eye. It's about as big as the full moon, but it's really faint. That's why you don't notice it unless you know where you're looking. With binoculars, it's pretty easy to find.
I'm putting binoculars on my Christmas list this year, Terry. You've convinced me. Well, before we let you go, we've chatted all this year about all sorts of incredibly cool and beautiful phenomena in the night sky, but you have taken some incredible images this year. We're going to put them on our website at cfpublic.org/space, but I want you to walk me through these. The first one I'm looking at is this aurora display that you took. Can you tell me a bit about this image?
I happened to be traveling in New Zealand with my wife at the time, and we were out on a lake near Queenstown in New Zealand, and around midnight, the whole sky lit up with aurora. The entire world, even down to the latitudes of Florida, were seeing aurora on that night. Of course, I was at a southern latitude farther down near the South Pole where the aurora was truly spectacular, and it was the highest class of geomagnetic storm that's been recorded in several hundred years, apparently. So-called G5, you know, that's kind of the top of the Richter scale for solar storms. And it really lit up the whole sky for about 6 hours. And the sun is still at the peak of its 11-year activity cycle. We've had several outbursts since then, none of which were as dramatic as May 10th. But there's a pretty good chance that over the next 3, 4, or 5 months, there'll be a few other aurora events. And I'm crossing my fingers every time I go out in the evening or morning. I take my binoculars out. So far, no luck. But you can get an advance warning of possible auroras and what places are best to see them by Googling the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, geomagnetic storm. So when the sun belches out a big flare or coronal mass ejection, it takes several hours to several days for those particles and that radiation to hit the Earth's atmosphere and magnetosphere. We do get some advance warning.
I have never been able to see an aurora, and I'm hoping to see one soon. But when I've seen images of them, there's usually this, it's like teal and blue and purple, but the image you captured is very pinkish red. Is that because of the location, or was this just happens to be a phenomenon of this particular ejection?
Well, this, like I said, the largest outburst in pretty much recorded history. The Earth's atmosphere is predominantly nitrogen and oxygen with an admixture of argon and a few other trace elements. And depending upon how energetic the protons and electrons and radiant energy coming from the sun, depending on how much energy that contains, when it hits the magnetic field of the Earth, magnetic field guides those particles towards the north and south magnetic poles, where if they're violent enough, they can reach the upper atmosphere and cause the nitrogen and oxygen molecules in our atmosphere to fluoresce like a light bulb. And it just turns out that nitrogen and oxygen prefer to radiate at red and green wavelengths. Although the upper atmosphere, atomic nitrogen and oxygen can emit purple and maybe even other colors depending upon how energetic the electrons and protons are. So basically the colors are determined by the kinds of particles and how fast they're moving when they hit our atmosphere.
I also want to talk about this other one you have that's a little bit closer to home that was taken from your neighborhood near Melbourne, Florida. It was a comet. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name of it, but it's a stunning, stunning image.
That was well placed for us for several weeks throughout October and early November, and you couldn't miss it if you knew that it was out there. You could just walk out and see it for several weeks. We had another comet that was sighted not much earlier than that one. It was dubbed the Halloween comet because it was bound about Halloween. It was scheduled to go so close to the sun that we thought it was really going to flare up and be visible in broad daylight. But lo and behold, on October 31st or thereabouts, when it did get close to the sun, it broke up and fell into the sun. And in other words, poof, it's gone. But on the bright side, pun intended, there's yet another comet that's expected to be maybe as bright as Venus, and I know that's really on shaky ground predicting brightnesses of comets. Another so-called sun comet's coming by, and in mid-January, it may very well be visible to the naked eye, intentionally as bright as Venus.
Terry Oswalt, thank you so much for sharing what we should be looking at in the night sky and sharing some of your gorgeous photographs of these astronomical phenoms. Terry, always great to chat with you.
Thank you very much.
Terry Oswalt is an astronomer and associate dean of the Physical Sciences Department at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. Still to come, there's a new race to the moon, and what happens if the U.S. doesn't win?
And if you want to own the future, you need to be one of the countries that is working on the moon, going to Mars.
A look at the book, Red Moon Rising, How America Will Beat China on the Final Frontier. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The space race. In 1969, the U.S. landed the first humans on the moon. At the time, the nation's challenger was the Soviet Union. But now, a new kind of space race is in full swing, this time with China. While China plans to land humans on the moon in 2030, leaders in the U.S. have raised concerns that China could put humans on the lunar surface before the U.S. Greg Autry says the U.S. can make it to the moon with the Artemis missions before China, and he outlines his argument in his new book, Red Moon Rising, How America Will Beat China on the Final Frontier. Here to talk about his book and the new challenge between these two nations is Greg Autry. Greg, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So, Greg, last week, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson said that there was going to be a delay in the Artemis program, the first circumlunar trip in 2026 and then lunar landing in 2027. But he did mention that this would still beat the Chinese space agency to the moon, which is thinking about getting there in 2030. My question to you, Greg, is should the threat of China really be propelling the space program forward? Are they that big of a threat?
Well, you know, I wrote a book on this topic. And, you know, actually, the thesis of Red Moon Rising is that it's good that we have a competitive challenge. So I almost want to kind of avoid the word threat and just say challenge. But I spend some time with history in the book and talk about how the Soviet Union was significantly damaged, both in their internal sense of identity and success as a superpower and globally by their failure to best America in the first space race and get to the moon. It's almost a turning point that you could point at in the early 1970s and say, this is where the Soviet Union started to go downhill. So I do think that there's an important component to doing that. And the fact that we said we were going to do it back in the first Trump term, it's important that we follow through. And the Biden team has committed to that of all things and all of Trump's policy. Continuing that was perhaps the thing that they continued a commitment to. And so we have the world looking at us. We've signed up 48 countries in the Artemis Accords. To not do that or to not even be able to do it as somebody who hasn't done it as quickly as somebody who hasn't done it before and doesn't have all the advantages America has would not look good.
It's painted as a new space race, right? That with China. Is that fair to call it that? I mean, are we looking at kind of the same momentum that we had in the 60s and 70s, as you mentioned, when the U.S. was racing the Soviet Union to the moon?
You know, I do think so. And I think from China's perspective, it's their opportunity to establish themselves as the world's leader in technology, essentially can-do-itness. And it's something they would really like to do. And for the United States to, again, fail to do so, I think looks poor. So I do believe there's a race, and it looks tight to me because China said they're going to be there in 2030, and all the indications are they're ahead of schedule, and they have a tendency to execute on schedule. And that's something that, for whatever reason, we've not been doing for quite some time.
As someone who is very intimate with space policy and space programs, what evidence does China have that they are moving towards that 2030 goal? And as you say, maybe even getting there before there. What evidence is there out there that this program is moving forward?
Well, first of all, there's the evidence of their success in other categories in related areas. So basically, when they've said they're going to do something in space, whether that was build a space station or put landers on the far side of the moon or land on Mars, they've done it. And they've done it on the dates they said they were going to do it. Their lunar lander program, in particular with the robotic landers, has been nothing short of magnificent. They've hit their schedules. They've been able to land multiple times on the moon, deploy rovers, and do sample return missions back from the moon twice, as well as land on the far side of the moon, which the U.S. hasn't done before, and down on the south polar regions, which are the critical resource areas everybody's interested in right now. The U.S., on the other hand, has attempted two moon landings with robotic landers this year, and they both failed. One didn't even get out of Earth orbit, and the other one landed on the moon and fell over. Then their actual announcements about where they are with their human lander program state that they're ahead of schedule, that their landers are ready, their spacesuits are ready. These are two components that we don't have ready.
Those landers that you mentioned, those were commercially built landers, part of a NASA program to leverage private partnerships to get to the moon. China's was state-run. Is that why, do you think, China had success there? And will the fact that China has a more national space program, is that an advantage for them?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting another component of my book, and perhaps the sub-thesis, which The subtitle is How America Will Beat China on the Final Frontier. And my argument is that commercial is our superpower, that we've got all of these really interesting space startups and great traditional companies who have years worth of experience doing this. And by turning loose the power of our markets and commercial sector, that they will succeed where we can't beat China in communism, basically. If you want to run a big state-controlled, centrally planned engineering program, they're going to win. So now the fact that their lander's ready and ours isn't and their space program is on track, I think more than anything has to do with the fact they've chosen very, very simple architecture and technological choices. They've got two launches in their system, one with the lander and one with the crew, basically, and we've developed a much more complicated architecture with a lot more vendors in it and our international partners. Our landers in particular are going to be a much more sophisticated and reusable solution for further sustainable lunar exploration than theirs will be.
And that's what you argue in the book needs to happen, right? Beat China to the moon, stay on the moon, and develop the moon. And that is built into those landers, that hardware that you mentioned. Why is it so important that we do more than just plant the flag of the Apollo days and really live and work and develop the moon?
That is an excellent point. And I'd like to note that Lori Garver, who served as deputy NASA administrator under President Obama, always likes to say, whenever I suggest there's a space race, she'll pop up and say, no, the U.S. already won a race. We did this six times back in the 1970s. This is a race for seventh place. And the fact of the matter is, yeah, if it's just about planting a flag, we've done that. There's no reason to waste the American taxpayers' money to show that we can do that again. And we've got actually a giant warehouse full of moon rocks at Johnson Space Center, some of which haven't been looked yet because they intentionally are holding them to release them over time as technology to analyze them improves. So that's not what it's about. What it's about is sustainable presence on the moon so that we can begin to do economic development. There's benefits both economically and environmentally that can come from developing the moon. And further, so that we can actually be there sustainably and permanently, allowing people to eventually begin lives off for the Earth, the concept of space settlement.
Let me ask you about that economic development, Greg. What stands to gain with that, and what does it look like?
Right. So the moon is a large piece of dead rock, essentially about the size of the continent of Africa from a surface area standpoint. It is full of basically the same sorts of materials that we find on the surface of the Earth, and then a few different things. If you look at the moon, the first thing you probably think of is craters. And why are there craters there? Because that's where large asteroids impacted the moon. Many of those asteroids have metallic cores full of valuable materials that we like, and they're sitting there in the middle of those craters, or the asteroid core dispersed those materials into the lunar regolith, eventually mining in particular metallic elements on the moon, smelting them there, developing unique alloys and materials that can actually only be made in microgravity as opposed to on Earth, and then returning some of those materials to the Earth can give us a way to move our dirty and extractive industries off of the Earth and into an environment where you don't have to worry about destroying the Brazilian rainforest, you know, or tearing up the tundra or the desert of Arizona. In the long run, we think that it's going to be a necessity and of great value for Earth, and more importantly, developing actual infrastructure and space to carry people farther. That's kind of hard to wrap your head around why you care about economic development off the Earth.
Does that run into some issues? Like, I remember we spoke with Bob Richards years ago for a series we did on turning to the moon. And I asked him who owns the moon, and his answer was everyone and no one. Because really, it is kind of a gray area, right? I mean, what happens if China and the U.S. do get there and there are a fight over resources?
The well-meaning, but I think misguided 1967 Outer Space Treaty that the U.S. and every spacefaring nation is party to basically says that there can be no claims of national sovereignty on the moon, so you can't say this is our territory. And that seemed to be a way to deconflict space, but I think it actually really missed the point that by not having national sovereignty, there's no clarity on who could, for instance, say that you have the right to operate in this area and extract resources, or to adjudicate a conflict, or to enforce an adjudication if there was one. So you end up kind of with the Wild West from an individual player's standpoint. If these are firms or individuals trying to operate in the lunar environment, they've got this treaty that's really signed by nation states that said you can't do that. I was with a group of folks in Lisbon at the Space Economy Summit this week, and I was on a panel with my good friend Andy Aldrin, and this question came up, and you know, I said, Andy, I wish your dad had gone up there with Neil and planted the flag and said, this is ours, because it would be a lot simpler. And frankly, I think that would be in everyone's best interest, because U.S. law, the humble opinion, is the best to operate under from a market standpoint. And so yeah, we are in an ambiguous situation, and I think it would be better if we weren't. It's something that's going to have to be worked out, and the U.S. is trying hard to interpret the 67 Outer Space Treaty in a way that works for commercial developers.
Greg, is China the only actor that the U.S. needs to be worried about? Are there other countries that have similar moon ambitions?
In my opinion, China's the only one we need to be worried about. So we have signed up another number of countries in the Artemis Accords, notably, you know, Canada, Japan, many of our European partners from ESA. And I think they're going to be our partners in this development plan. And the Artemis Accords include the U.S. interpretation of commercial activity, the ability to extract resources and resell them. I think that's fine. On the other side, China and Russia have an international lunar research station plan. In my opinion, we don't need to worry too much about anybody in that group besides China. It's China, Russia, Venezuela, Pakistan, but basically nobody who's actually going to do anything besides China. Russia's space program, unfortunately, is on its heels, and there's no sign of it getting better.
Greg, I'm going to end our conversation with a question. What happens if we lose?
Like I said, you could look at the Soviet Union from a global reputation position. I think it's a bad day. Even if we don't get done on time, I don't think Congress wants to fund the silver medal. And then in the very, very long run, the high ground is militarily and economically important. If you want to own the future, you need to be one of the countries that is working on the moon, going to Mars, and carrying humanity forward, or you're simply going to be part of the past. There's a really good lesson that I cover in the book. Back in the early 15th century, the 1420s, the Chinese were aggressive explorers of the Earth. They had huge fleets of ships that were traveling. And there's every reason to believe that if they had continued those voyages of exploration, they would have rounded the Cape of Good Hope and probably arrived in the New World and in Europe before the end of the 15th century. Unfortunately, they made a political decision to stop doing that. And what happened instead was the Europeans colonized the world and ended up subjugating China to what China calls the century of humiliation, which was actually more than 100 years, but a long period of time when they did not have the respect that they felt they were due and were economically subjugated. And we don't want to go there. It's important that we finish this job that we started. We have everything we need to do it, and our commercial sector is the way to get out there and win.
Greg Autry is the author of Red Moon Rising, How America Will Beat China on the Final Frontier. He's also the Associate Provost for Space Commercialization and Strategy at the University of Central Florida. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or really wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. Find us at AWTY Space. If you have an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out to us. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. More space news online, visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.